Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio in Fresno and Bakersfield, this is Valley Edition, FM 89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea joins us to talk about some of the biggest issues facing the county, everything from the budget to jail expansion and the future of the county's relationship with Community Regional Medical Center. We'll also talk with a journalist from the Center for Investigative Reporting about a major scam that's been going on in the state's Medi-Cal drug treatment program. We'll find out how providers have been scamming the system and what's being done to stop it. And finally, we'll close our show with John Binet. He's the wine critic from the San Francisco Chronicle and the author of a new book documenting the revolution in California wine that's taking place right now. We'll get his thoughts on the new generation of California winemakers and how the San Joaquin Valley plays a vital role in the state's fast-changing wine industry. Those stories and much more coming up in just a moment. But first, this news update.
With these news headlines, I'm Ezra David Romero. California Governor Jerry Brown says tens of thousands of unemployed Californians will soon be without jobless benefits, and he's asking federal lawmakers to intervene. From Sacramento, Marianne Russ reports.
Governor Brown has sent a letter to House Speaker John Boehner, Majority Leader Harry Reid, and Minority Leaders Nancy Pelosi and Mitch McConnell. In it, he urges Congress to extend benefits for those who are still without jobs. The federal extension has helped people who used up their regular state unemployment benefits over the past several years, but they're set to expire in a week and a half. Brown is asking Congress to pass legislation to keep the federal extension going through the end of next year. He says otherwise, more than 214,000 Californians will lose their benefits and suffer irreparable harm. In his letter, Brown also calls California's unemployment insurance program severely underfunded by the federal government and blames that for delays in benefits. In Sacramento, I'm Marianne Russ.
Governor Jerry Brown says California's rollout of the new federal health care law is on solid ground, but he's not willing to declare himself satisfied.
This is a big, huge, impactful program. All the things that are going to follow from it are not clear. So rather than taking satisfaction, I'd rather take precautions.
The governor says California's rollout is going better than the national effort, and his healthcare advisors are cautiously optimistic about the state's success. The state of California is considering new rules that could allow transgender athletes to compete in boxing, kickboxing, and mixed martial arts events. As Katie Orr reports from Sacramento, the proposed regulations were presented Monday.
Under the proposed rules put forward by the California Athletic Commission, transgender athletes would be required to have undergone hormone therapy for at least 2 years before competing. A testing procedure for transgender athletes would also be established. Commissioner Christopher Giza says the rules attempt to strike a balance.
Everybody has a right to participate in sports, but we need to find a way to allow them to participate safely for both contestants, for both the transgender athlete as well as the non-transgender.
Giza says the regulations would bring the commission in line with other sports organizations like the Olympics and the NCAA, which already have transgender policies on their books. Public testimony will be heard in the next few months. The rules could take up to a year to go into effect. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Orr.
4 years after two Fresno police officers shot and killed Fresno man Stephen Willis, a federal jury began the process Monday of deciding whether his death resulted from his own actions or excessive force. His parents' lawyers say the Fresno Police Department should pay $15 million in damages for causing Willis's death. Officers say that Willis pointed a revolver at them and they feared for their lives. But his parents say he was just transporting his gun into his home after a day at the shooting range. For Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
You're listening to Valley Edition. From the controversy over the Fresno County Coroner's Office to the proposed expansion of the county jail, there's been a lot of big issues before county officials in recent weeks. Here to talk about those and other topics is Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea. Supervisor Perea, welcome.
Oh, thank you. I'm glad to be on your show. Earlier this month, you were the lone member of the Board of Supervisors to vote against a controversial proposal to eliminate the office of coroner public administrator as an independent elected office and to consolidate those duties under the sheriff and the DA. This particular move caused a lot of head scratching in the community. There didn't seem to be a lot of analysis on this rather swift decision and vote by the board. Though supporters say it will save the county money, is this a move you think the county will come to regret down the road?
You know, I think so. I think the sheriff in the 70s was wise in breaking the coroner's function away from his operation for two reasons. One was that, you know, he felt it was a conflict of interest for the sheriff to be involved in some cases investigating a death or a questionable death that his office or another local law enforcement office may be involved in. And on top of that, you know, the coroner's function is not really a law enforcement activity. So that move was made. I think it was a good move, and we've been served well by independent coroners. But this last minute move to make this move really still doesn't make a whole lot of sense from an operational standpoint, a fiscal standpoint, or just the perception of conflict of interest that is now maybe created in this community.
You've actually said you think it's going to cost the county more money down the road. Supervisor Bucchigi and others say there's synergies. The district attorney says we'll be able to save money on certain things. What are your concerns fiscally about this?
Well, I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that the major portion of the coroner function, which will go into the sheriff's department, at the minimum is going to have a sheriff's lieutenant overseeing it. Now that number alone, you're talking about almost $250,000 in supervision of just that one position, which already far exceeds the $200,000 savings that was identified by staff in making the move. So right off the bat, we know it's going to cost us more money. But, you know, knowing the way bureaucracy works, I said before that it's all said and done, that's going to be a $300,000 to $500,000 operation. And again, I don't see what the efficiency would be there. Certainly don't see why it's a good use of taxpayer dollars. And more importantly, why we would take away the voice of the voters to decide who their coroner is going to be is beyond me. And, you know, having talked to the sheriff and the DA in the last month or so, they weren't even aware of this process being put into motion. So, you know, you would think if you're going to disseminate one elected office and put it into two other elected offices, they would at least know or have a reason to be a part of it. So, I don't know. It just didn't seem right considering all that's involved with it.
Late last week, the executive board of the State and Community Corrections recommended moving forward with a plan to award Fresno County $79 million to fund the construction of a new jail facility. This is part of the state's criminal justice realignment effort. The final decision is likely to come from Sacramento next month. How confident are you that the county is going to actually be able to adequately staff this facility if it is built moving forward, considering we're coming off of years of jail floors being closed due to lack of adequate staffing?
You know, that was our biggest concern, that we would be able to meet the long-term obligation to staff it. But at this point, I feel very confident that we will, because even though it's adding, or there will be 300 beds when this is all said and done, a lot of this is going to be replacement beds. So the additional new beds that we will be adding to that jail will be such that we will not have a problem guaranteeing or assuring the state that we will adequately staff those floors for the next 30 years. I think what was really important to us as a board and the opportunity that we saw is we're replacing replacing the oldest jail that we have in Fresno County. And really, it is just not fit for humans to be placed in it. And I think, yes, they're there and there for crimes that they have committed or been accused of committing, but they do deserve some level of dignity when they are being held against their will in a jail situation. So having said that, and along with the fact that we're going to be building a jail that has a lot of mental health and rehab, alcohol and drug rehab facilities built into it, that's new, that's innovative, and that's something that's required by the state too. And we really want to be a part of working with people that want to be worked with and helped. You know, if they want treatment programs, that they're going to be there on site to help them, you know, break the cycle, that whatever it is that they're in, and keep them out of jail in the future. So I think it's a win all the way around for the sheriff, who does need new updated facilities, for the community, who does want facilities when people should be incarcerated for whatever crime they've committed or been accused of committing, that they know that their public safety is being cared for. But by the same token, for those that are in the facility, once they know that they want help, that we have it there for them. So I think it's a win all the way around.
Another big controversial issue that was before county supervisors earlier this month was the issue of medical marijuana cultivation and commercial cultivation, which the board voted to ban recently. Tell us your thoughts on that. There's a lot of concerns from medical marijuana advocates saying that this is going to make it much more difficult for patients to get their medicine. But the sheriff and others are very concerned, as many of the board of supervisors are, about the way that this has been growing in the county and the foothill areas and rural areas throughout the county. What are your thoughts on that issue?
Yeah, well, you know, first, let me say it was a very difficult decision, not just for me, but for our board. You know, a few years back, we started implementing the medical marijuana law where we issued the medical marijuana card, then set up the opportunity for dispensaries to operate within the county. But like anything new, you know, you're kind of creating the playbook as you go. And I think within that, what we found was a parallel track where you had the drug element of this community, whether it was the cartels from Mexico or people that were involved in criminal activity within, you know, our own community, took advantage of the medical marijuana issue and started using the medical marijuana cards of either patients or people that they paid money to become patients, so that they could then start growing marijuana on the valley floor. And I think fast forward a couple of years, it was no question out of control within this community, whether it was large pieces of land or all of a backyard being used to grow marijuana, to people who were leasing houses and neighborhoods and converting the entire houses to medical marijuana growth. And from experience, we know a lot of this was not going for medical marijuana users. It was just folks using this this loosely written law and an implementation of the law to get marijuana into the black market so they can make maximum profit. So I think what we did is we pushed rewind and said, look, we need to stop all growing of medical marijuana in this, or rather all marijuana in this community, until we figure out a more reasonable way, legitimate way to get medical marijuana to those patients that are really in need of the medicine, meet their needs. You know, and I think some of us are looking at, well, does it make sense to work with pharmaceutical companies to make it a licensed drug and sell it through a pharmacy like any other medicine? So getting medical marijuana cards from doctors who are truly licensed and prepared to give that type of evaluation and prescription? Or do we look at the county health department with an adequate, safe provider of marijuana to become the dispensary for folks that truly need it? So bottom line is two issues there. One is for folks who need medical marijuana, we need to figure out how to get it to them. That's why we pushed the reset button. Now, the broader issue of just growing marijuana, period, I know a lot of folks are saying, well, gosh, you know, why don't we just make it legal and you can tax it and you can, you know, do all the great things that you can with marijuana. Well, that's great. When the folks put that on the ballot, and when they pass that initiative, then we'll deal with that and implement that law. But right now, we're not dealing with just letting everyone grow marijuana because maybe someday it'll be legal. It's the issue of medical marijuana.
Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea joins us on our program today. Let's turn to health care now. The county has a lengthy contract with Community Regional Medical Center to provide indigent care for county residents. With the expansion of coverage under the Affordable Care Act, a lot of the money the county gets to pay for that is going away. But there's still a lot of people in the county, many of them undocumented, who will still need this sort of care. Do you envision a situation where the county and the CRMC agree to tear up the current contract? And if so, how close are we to seeing that sort of a change?
Well, you know, that issue is such a, like everything we've talked about so far, it's really huge and has a lot of impacts to this county. But as we speak, I mean, this healthcare one is evolving. And I think in the very near future, we just may be ending the contract with community hospitals and going a different direction on the healthcare piece of it. But no question, we're very concerned right now, and I know I'm very concerned about the fact that there is a hole now for the undocumented care in Fresno County. And we need to figure out a way beyond emergency care, which, I mean, folks, any individual is entitled to the emergency care. But we're talking about the preventative care that every day people may need, whether it's, you know, eyeglasses or they, you know, they fell and maybe have broken a finger. I mean, people need care. And if we're going to have undocumented folks in our country, you know, doing the work that nobody else wants to do, whether it be in the fields or in the service industry or in construction, then we can't turn a blind eye and then reap all the benefits of their labor for making our lives easier. Then say, hey, guess what? You don't deserve the basic right of being cared for when you're ill. That doesn't work for me. So big issue. We may be ending that contract with community hospital, but somewhere in between that, we have to figure out how to fill that gap of care for people that need it.
Is the county prepared by handing over those responsibilities to community? The county divested itself a lot of the infrastructure and means to do those sorts of things. Are you confident with the ability of the county to move forward with that sort of thing, given the dramatic changes that have taken place?
Well, we're certainly not prepared to go into the healthcare business directly, you know, in the next couple of months. But I think what we're looking at is with the changing economics of the dollars that are coming in or being diverted to the state under other programs, is there some way that we can capture a portion of those funds to provide that care for the undocumented? Then the question would be, is the other clinic systems that we do have in operation within Fresno County, contracting with them to provide that care? So that's what I would see happening.
Moving on to First Five, there's been considerable discussion and disagreement about the direction of First Five Fresno County. It all boiled over in the debate over the plans for the new $10 million facility First Five is planning to build in downtown Fresno. You chair the board for First Five. How do you respond to the criticism that was so heated earlier this year about the agency and this facility, which your board voted to move forward on? The First Five board, I should say, voted to move forward on back in November. People have said it's too expensive, it's not helping kids. Others have said it's essential for this organization. How do you respond to those?
Well, first, I mean, I think we have to respect the fact that our board has some questions and they needed to be answered, and that's fine. I mean, that's the democratic process, and we conduct the public's business in the public, and that's fine. I'm also very confident in the First Five Commission in terms of what the work that is done, that is doing now, and then what it will do in the future. What we do know is this: the tobacco tax funding is going down. You know, people are smoking less, and that's good. But what it means for the First Five Commission is, just a few years ago, they had about a $22 million budget, and now it's down to about a $12 million budget. So the commission, I believe, made a really good decision a couple of years ago in saying, we can't just keep handing out money to programs, and then as the money diminishes, you know, at some point the programs will go away because the money's not there anymore. What we have to do is shift our strategy to giving people more of an opportunity for long-term sustainability in their programs. So that was the shift or the pivot in looking at building the building, where not only would it house the First Five operations, which would save us money to rent that we're paying now, but it's more in terms of now using this as a major hub of capacity building for a lot of these agencies that receive our help, as well as help from other folks, but having them now come in and be a part of how do we help you long-term to be sustainable. And that could mean how best to do your finances, how best to run your operation, how best to write grants, you know, things that will make them be more sustainable long-term in the event First Five dollars continue to dwindle and at some point dwindle away. So the capacity is there within that structure, not just to house our operations and a child care center that is built into it, but also all those other things that we will do to help those organizations maintain sustainability. So, yeah, I mean, I know there's some philosophical disagreements between some folks on that point, but, you know, I'm comfortable, as well as the rest of the commission, that we are pivoting in the right direction to help people long-term in their programs.
Moving on to another county issue, the Public Defender's Office has been under scrutiny for some time. Earlier this year, at least one outside group, the Sixth Amendment Center, called on the Department of Justice to investigate staffing levels and things. The head of the office has announced he's retiring. What's your confidence in the way that the Public Defender's Office in Fresno County is serving the important role that it plays in our criminal justice system?
Well, you know, I do have concerns. I think over the years, over the last, especially 3 or 4 years, when we had some pretty significant budget cuts, and everybody knows we had to take cuts countywide, but, you know, I think the Public Defender's Office took probably more than their share of cuts. And what we did, I think, is we've created an imbalance in the justice system in this county where we've always known we're not going to have a one-to-one relationship between the district attorney and public defender's office, but we needed to be closer than what we are today. So having said that, I mean, they are pretty much low on staffing. I think we need to, as monies are getting better, we need to start beefing up that department so that we can maintain some type of a reasonable ratio between them and the district attorney's office. But one thing I do not support, and you know, could always rear its head at any time, is always been talk on occasions of privatizing the public defender's office. And I mean, I've been pretty clear on this for the past 9 years. I don't think you should put justice for sale in any community. And I think doing privatizing of a public defender's office would be just that, because no question a business makes money, in this case, by not filing cases, by not representing people. So I don't see how that serves, you know, the general good of Fresno County residents when they need the help of a public defender. So I think the real work is, how does our board figure out how to give them adequate funding so they can get their job done?
You mentioned briefly the improving revenues. The economy, by all accounts, is improving. That can only mean good things for the county budget overall. What are your priorities looking forward as the county in 2014 is going to be working on crafting the new budget? What are your areas of priority to restore funding and priorities for the future?
Well, let me do two things that I say are parallel priorities to me. One is spending the resources we need to make Fresno County a lot more job-friendly than what it is today. And what that means is setting up the opportunities for businesses to move into Fresno County, which does two things. One, obviously, it brings business and creates jobs, but also gives us the opportunity of expanding our tax base even more. So I think that has to be a very high priority. Beyond that, assuming that we do have more revenue, and I think we will, I think we need to start rebuilding the programs that we've decimated over the last several years. And I think I would start with functions like the public defender's office. I would go into our health, our mental health departments, public health departments, and start rebuilding programs that were either eliminated or severely reduced. One example, infant mortality, and specifically black infant mortality. A few years ago, we had a pretty robust operation making sure that we were working with young moms that were expecting children. That program has been, I mean, completely decimated. And we shouldn't be surprised at the fact that black infant death mortality has skyrocketed in Fresno County. I mean, that's cause and effect. I think we really need to go back and take a look at our public health programs, our mental health programs, community-based type programs, and start beefing up programs that have either gone away or been reduced. So I think we do that simultaneously, I think we'll be okay. Public safety can always use more money, but I think we've been very, very supportive and generous with public safety. I think it's now time to find a little more balance in the community.
Fresno County Supervisor Henry Perea talking with us today on Valley Edition. Supervisor Perea, thank you so much for taking the time.
You bet. Thank you.
Stay with us here on Valley Edition. Later this hour, we'll talk with John Bonet, the wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, on his new book about the revolution in California wine, and get his thoughts on large-scale winemaking here in the Valley. We'll also find out why rampant fraud in California's Medi-Cal drug treatment program went on for years, and what's being done to stop it. That's all coming up in just a moment here on Valley Edition.
The end of the year is almost upon us. It's your last chance to make a donation to Valley Public Radio and receive a tax write-off for 2013. Your gift helps support the programs you enjoy every day, and come next April, it can have benefits as well. Make your tax-deductible donation at kvpr.org.
Gee, ain't it funny?
Thanks, and happy holidays.
Our time slips away.
Valley Edition. Starting in January, parents will need a doctor's note to excuse their kids from mandatory vaccinations here in California. But can clinicians convince them that childhood shots are safe? Deirdre Kennedy brings us this report from California Healthline, a daily news service of the California Healthcare Foundation.
The new law is designed to reverse the rising number of children entering school without inoculations. The bill's author, Richard Pan, is a pediatrician and chair of the State Assembly Health Committee. He says in recent decades, successful vaccination programs have all but eradicated disease like polio and measles, so many parents mistakenly think they're no longer a threat.
Anyone who thinks that vaccine-preventable illnesses can't come back, fortunately we're seeing this in Syria, a country where polio was essentially eliminated. Now you're seeing a resurgence of polio.
In California, there has been an increase in reported cases of pertussis, also known as whooping cough, which can be fatal, particularly for infants. As of November, the State Department of Public Health counted nearly 1,600 cases this year. 93 of those children were hospitalized, and 60 of them were infants under the age of 4 months. Pan says every child who gets vaccinated is helping others who can't get vaccinated, like people with HIV or babies too young to be vaccinated.
It's not just about getting immunization for the individual child. It's about the community, because the percentage of people who are immunized in the community has an impact on how many people in the community will get that vaccine-preventable illness.
Over the past century, vaccines have prevented more than 100 million children from getting communicable diseases. But when it comes to the individual children in a family, some parents worry that vaccines could do more harm than good. Mark Dressner, president of the California Academy of Family Physicians, says it doesn't make much sense when you look at the science.
It's against any kind of logic. It seems that no matter what you say to them about how infectious diseases have been prevented, and that the only reason that their children will be protected is because other children have been immunized, despite all that, they still do not want to immunize their children. And often they'll cite data from websites that just don't make any sense.
Over the past 5 years, the number of children with all required immunizations has dropped slightly, from 91.7% in the 2008 to 2009 school year to 90.3% in the 2012 school year. Public schools consistently have a higher vaccination rate than private schools. In fact, in several private schools in Napa and Sonoma counties, more than 90% of the students have personal exemptions on file. Dressner and Pan blame what they call misleading statements from anti-vaccine campaigns, including messages from Hollywood celebrities, such as this YouTube video narrated by comedian Rob Schneider.
In the last 30 years, the childhood vaccine schedule has tripled, while the U.S. autism rate has skyrocketed from 1 in 10,000 to 1 in 50. Dozens of published research papers show that, yes, vaccines and autism are linked.
That's the kind of blanket statement that gets Dressner upset. He says it plays on people's emotions but is untrue.
Association does not imply causation. For example, the incidence of obesity is on the rise, as well as the diagnosis of autism. Does this imply that obesity causes autism? Well, of course not.
Fears about a link between the measles vaccine and autism started with a 1998 study by British surgeon Andrew Wakefield that has since been widely discredited. But Barbara Lowe Fisher, president and co-founder of the National Vaccine Information Center, says there are still a lot of questions to be answered about the increase in doses of vaccines for kids and whether it contributes to brain and immune disorders in some individuals. NVIC supports dialogue between patients and physicians about inoculation, but she says consumers can't rely on physicians alone to give them the information they need to make an informed decision.
And that means, in my opinion, looking at the product manufacturer insert, for the legal information that is required by the FDA for the vaccine manufacturers to alert physicians as well as patients about reasons why you would not give the vaccine, reported vaccine adverse events that have been reported in the pre-licensure clinical trials.
Fisher says her own son had a bad reaction to the DPT vaccine that she says left him with learning difficulties and behavioral problems. She says each person's body responds differently to each vaccine, and some individuals are more susceptible to having a bad reaction. NVIC wants more research into whether the cause is genetic, biological, environmental, or something else. The new law starts January 1st and applies to all children whose parents and guardians want to opt out of getting them vaccinated.
That was reporter Deirdre Kennedy with California Healthline, a daily news service of the California Healthcare Foundation. You're listening to Valley Edition. Drug treatment facilities are designed to help people with substance abuse problems get back on their feet. But what happens when the state pays unscrupulous providers for treating people who don't need such care? Well, for quite some time, the answer was nothing. That was until the Center for Investigative Reporting and CNN launched a series of reports documenting fraud in California's drug Medi-Cal program. It's called Rehab Racket. Will Evans, money and politics reporter for CIR, joins us now on Valley Edition. Will, welcome.
Thank you.
How exactly does this scam work?
Well, basically, these are clinics that are billing Medicaid, you know, Medi-Cal, the insurance program for the poor, for each person who comes in, for each group or individual therapy session that they have. So they need bodies, or they need names, people with Medi-Cal numbers. So beyond that, it's sort of the limit is your own creativity. We have people billing for people who never came in. They're called ghost clients, making up counseling notes about people who didn't even come in. You have people busing in foster care children from group homes, whether or not they have addictions, and just signing them all up. You have people bringing in mentally disabled residents of board and care facilities, bribing people off the street with cigarettes or cash to come in. You just need bodies to fill the seats or make them up.
How lucrative of a racket was this for the companies that were engaging in this activity?
Well, you have people making millions of dollars off of this. We found that over the last two fiscal years, about $186 million went to these clinics, and half of that went to clinics that had shown signs of really questionable billing or even fraud.
And what is the scale of this problem? How long has it been going on, and is it spread throughout the state? I understand there's nearly 200 of these clinics that were involved at some level.
That's right. Yeah, we really found it very concentrated in L.A. and, to some extent, Riverside. But the clinics do exist throughout the state. And in terms of how long it's been going on, many years. You know, we found back, you know, regulators knew about this for at least 5 years, that the fraud was rampant, and yet very little was done.
Were there any safeguards in place at the state level to try to prevent this from happening, a check on this system, or was it just set up to be very vulnerable to such fraud?
Well, it's a combination of weak regulations and really lack of oversight on the part of state and county officials. There were systems set up to audit the clinics, check on their finances, check on their billings, and in many cases, the audits actually found serious problems. We read through hundreds of government audits, and that's the way we were able to document how big of a problem it was. They actually found this stuff, but they didn't do anything about it. You know, the clinics would be threatened with getting cut off because of clearly fraudulent behavior, where the auditors actually caught the clinics in the act making stuff up, and they would be threatened with having their contracts cut off, but it wouldn't happen year after year. So there was sort of a lack of political will to do anything about it, combined with it wasn't the strictest system in terms of regulations.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, we're talking with reporter Will Evans from the Center for Investigative Reporting. He's part of a project called Rehab Racket that CIR has launched together with CNN, documenting fraud in California's drug Medi-Cal program. You talk about each warm body being a renewable resource, representing about $27 in government funding for a group counseling session and $64 for a one-on-one appointment. Were these the folks who were getting these kickbacks, were they contacting these facilities and saying, hey, I want to sign up because I know I can get a kickback? Or was it a recruitment effort on behalf of the providers? How did that work? And were the group homes in some way participating in this at any level?
Yeah, the group homes were definitely involved. The clinics would reach out. They have a variety of different recruitment methods, and they would go to these group living facilities, board and cares for the elderly and mentally disabled, and hand out perks, you know, to the residents. Hand out packs of cigarettes, sometimes cash, you know, $5 a person. you know, come and you get coffee and donuts and burritos, those kinds of things that are significant perks for the people who are very down and out living at these places. And so that would be their way of luring the people in. Now, in order to get access to the people, some clinics would actually also bribe the home operators so that they could, they could pull up in their vans and count on these homes having the people ready to go, having, no problem with shipping them all off on buses, whether or not they actually needed treatment.
So since your series of reports have launched, there has been a number of changes here. Department of Justice obviously is now involved. There are a number of investigations of these 177 facilities. Are there some that are still operating? What's the status of the investigation from the federal level and also at the state and county level?
Well, it's really a state crackdown so far. They've suspended 177 clinic sites, so that includes the headquarters clinics and the satellite sites that they have throughout the region. And what that means when they suspend them is they're under investigation. Many of them have been referred to the Department of Justice. The DOJ has opened a lot of criminal probes. And meanwhile, their funding is completely cut off, so they really can't operate. Many of these were completely dependent on Medi-Cal funding to operate, so they've had to close their doors in the meantime. Now, a lot of them are appealing the suspension and are going to try to fight it out, and we'll see what happens.
Has the state taken any steps to change the way the system operates to prevent this from happening in the future?
They say they are. They say they're doing a top-to-bottom review. They're implementing long-term reforms. They say that they are going to increase the scrutiny on these clinics to do more in-depth clinic visits so that they don't just do these sort of, financial reviews from Sacramento. They actually go and check out whether the patients exist. They've closed a number of communication gaps, which were leading to, one hand didn't know what the other hand was doing, so the money would just keep flowing. The other thing we found was that the state was letting certain operators who never should have been operating continue and to open in the first place when they shouldn't have. They were convicted of organized crime, or they were actually on a banned list, people who are not allowed to bill Medi-Cal. They allowed people like that to open. So they say they're actually getting much more strict about that. They're requiring everybody in the whole state to reapply, and they hope they'll be able to root it out.
We've been talking with Will Evans. He is the money and politics reporter for the Center for Investigative Reporting. Together with CNN, CIR launched a series of investigative reports called Rehab Racket, documenting fraud in California's drug Medi-Cal treatment program. Will, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Listening to Valley Edition. For years, California winemakers have earned their reputation by producing big, bold wines, and they've used all that science has to offer to make the state a global behemoth in the worldwide industry. But there's also something else going on in California, a new generation of winemakers who are looking to old-world traditions for their inspiration, and in the process are creating something truly unique. They're the subject of a new book by our next guest, John Benet. Since 2006, he has been the wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle, and his book, The New California Wine, A Guide to the Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste, was published last month by 10 Speed Press. John Benet joins us now. John, welcome.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Revolution in taste. Revolution is a bold word. It implies a break from the past. What are the hallmarks of this revolution as you see it?
It was not a word we chose lightly, and it's a word I'm sure some folks think is probably too strong. What I would What I would describe it as is wines that do what California has historically done best, which is to offer both the complexity and the nuance that people have often associated with the old world with the exuberance that they can find in California. And for a long time, most of California wine was trying to emulate the first, and then for about 15 years or so, it was really chasing the second in what I call the era of big flavor. And I think what we're seeing now is people turning away from just sheer impact to wines that offer a true perspective on the glorious diversity of what California can offer.
You use a very interesting word when you're talking about some of the winemaking practices that have made California so popular and such a big industry. And you use the word technocratic. You talk about this battle between technocratic winemaking and artistic winemaking. What do you mean by that?
I think technocratic is simply acknowledging that the way that the post-war industry in California was built up, in no small part with the work from UC Davis, but also Fresno State and other places, placed an enormous focus on the science of winemaking. And that's not a bad thing. You want to be able to employ it in appropriate ways. But especially as the industry grew really faster than anyone could keep up with it, it became very convenient for science to be the only mode of work in the cellar and for people to simply run their wineries on the numbers. And I think anyone who really believes in the timelessness of wine as a culture has to accept that you just don't make great wine that way. You have to pull away and really see what the specifics of the place that you want to farm can give you, what the vintage will give you, rather than simply sort of adding a commercial yeast that will give you one flavor or another, making sure you hit all your chemistry, and sort of following quite literally a textbook approach to winemaking.
Now, you're from the East Coast originally, spent a lot of time in the Northwest, and as I understand it, you came to your current job with a bit of a reputation among some in the wine industry. How has your experience both on the East Coast and also in Washington and other places shaped your ability to tell this story?
Well, I grew up in New York, and I grew up with, obviously, a fair amount of European wine, but also a fair amount of California wine. There was absolutely, bottles from folks like Robert Mondavi on our table, and enough that when I came out to California for the first time as a kid, really, in 1985, it was very clear to me when we went to Napa just how special a place it was, and then went to college, did all sorts of other stuff, moved to Seattle, as you say, and really happened to be lucky enough to be in the Northwest at a time when especially Washington industry was just booming, and really in a large part it was built on the growth of small wineries, and I became very used to walking into these no-frill warehouses in South Seattle, wherever, and seeing basically, a mom-and-pop operation, quite literally, that were making some of the best wines in the Northwest, and we're getting recognition for them. And so what I think that imprinted on me was that American wine had a great potential future at small scale, and that as much as there obviously is a big industry in wine, that what would push forward the tastes of Americans in terms of the wines that we'd like to drink, what would push forward California's and America's reputation as a global wine producer was going to come from a small scale. And so when I got here, it was more than a little bit of culture shock.
Tell us about how has that changed? You document so many of the people who are leading this revolution, the winemakers and folks who are pursuing their own path and doing it at a very small scale. You talk about the folks who are doing urban winemaking. They're renting warehouse space and something that is not often our traditional romantic notion of the winemaker out in the estate. How has that changed, and who are some of the people who are leading this revolution?
I think what I saw was that there have always been small winemakers in California, and there's always been folks who've really worked diligently, often not getting a ton of attention. But I think you know, a few years after I was here, and I was really looking for folks who I felt sort of shared my view of how the wine world worked, it became evident that there were more and more winemakers, you know, at small wineries, often sort of running their label, you know, in the second 12 hours of their day after their day job, who were asking the same questions that I was about what can California represent in terms of wine? What can it produce? What is its great potential? What can it offer to the world? And at first, you know, you would find a handful of, or I found a handful of folks who were doing this. Folks like a guy named Abe Scherner, who had a very kind of small, semi-experimental winery called the Scolium Project. A guy named Steve Mathiasen, who actually started in the Central Valley and in Lodi, working on organic agriculture and other stuff, and then kind of moved to grapes, and then eventually moved to Napa, and has become a very prominent viticulturist, and really started to ask deep, deep questions, one about how Cabernet should be farmed, but also about what else Napa could produce. People like Ted Lemon of Literai, who is on the cover of the book, for no small reason, who was, among other things, the first American to run a domain in Burgundy, but then came back here, and rather than what people often talk about, which is wanting to make Burgundian wine, he said he wanted to apply all the things he had learned to really discover the full potential of the North Coast in his case, and also to having seen really kind of awful farming in Burgundy, you know, really, you know, just dramatically dead soils, that he wanted to go and look at how you could farm in a brilliant, distinctive way that would let you get to real quality and to real terroir.
If you just joined us on Valley Edition, our guest today is John Bonnet. He is the author of the book, The New California Wine, A Guide to the Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste. He's also the San Francisco Chronicle's wine critic. And this book is really interesting in that you go through all the different regions in the state and talk about what people should look for and who are the people who are doing some really interesting things. And also really, from a journalist perspective, do a great job of telling some very fascinating stories about the personality behind the wine and the winemaking world. I want to talk about the San Joaquin Valley in a little bit, but before we do that, you talk about this new revolution. You also, though, mentioned that in some ways it's a return to not only old world traditions, but California traditions and bringing back some of those old flavors.
Yeah, I think if you look at the style of wine that that people made, let's say 40 years ago, when the Robert Mondavis and Warren Winiarskis and Beau Barretts and Paul Drapers of the world were really kind of finding their footing and really showing the world how great California could be, the wines were Californian in a very distinctive way, but they, and to the point I should say that the French sort of mocked them for being too ripe, and these are wines that maybe 12.5% alcohol. But they were wines that had a correspondence, let's say, to styles of wine that existed elsewhere in the world. And Cabernets were made to be somewhat longer lasting and fresher. And as I often like to say, they tasted like Cabernet rather than just like capital W wine. And Zinfandels were absolutely robust. I mean, that was an era when Amador Zins, which even, you know, were big, but not nearly at the level of flavor that they've sort of grown to and the sweetness they've grown to, found an audience when, in fact, Zinfandel had an extraordinary diversity of style, and people made Zinfandel Nouveau. They made claret-style Zinfandels. And in some ways, it's simply going back, and, in you know, with the knowledge of 40 years of winemaking, saying, what was it about these wines that people loved? What is it about old vines Zinfandel that really is distinctive in a way that no other wines in the world can be? What is it about, frankly, grapes that have been in California a long time and everyone forgot about, like, say, Trousseau, which is both the great grape of Francis Jura, but also a port grape and known as Bastardo, and had been in the field all over the place in the 19th century, totally forgotten about, and then slowly sort of rediscovered here. Why should that not be a California grape? And so one of the things that frankly surprised me as I did more reporting on this was, in some ways, so much of the things that are exciting to me now are very much based in the past, not in the sort of short-term history as people come to think of California, where everything is Cabernet and Chardonnay. And both those grapes really have maybe a half-century history, even less in some ways if you look at the acreage growth. There's so much that has gone on in the state in terms of a diversity of winemaking, a diversity in the field, and in some ways we're simply circling back to acknowledge just how much California can do.
Let's turn now to an area you call the Abyss, the Central Valley. You also call it the fiscal core of California winemaking, and it really makes the whole system work. What do you mean by that?
It was very important to me when I was reporting for the book that I get out and I see the side of California that I hadn't really seen. I think almost no wine writer ever goes to see. And so I reached out to some folks, and they wanted to go to maybe Clarksburg and Lodi, and that was fine. But I said, I want to get to the thick of it. I want to see the real heart of what sort of, you know, cheap table wine comes from. And so ultimately we made our way to Madeira, and to me, actually, this is one of the most interesting parts of the book. And I have to say, the Abyss was actually not my term. It was a term coined by one of the folks who took me out there, but it was really crucial to me to get out and see what sort of industrial scale farming looks like, what it's like to farm, say, French Colombard at 25 tons an acre. And really the most significant thing to me was that it is possible to make that a profitable venture when you look at it simply as large-scale farming would be for any other crop. But the flip side being that my takeaway was that the economics of farming for really cheap wine are brutal. And I think have probably over time not served growers terribly well. I think growers, have, if anything, are now more worried and more distrustful of large wine companies who have an extraordinary way of fiddling with contracts to suit their needs. And so it was one thing where I sort of wanted to go to the absolute opposite end of where kind of $20,000 a ton Napa Cabernet farming is, just to see how the world works. And it was eye-opening. It was eye-opening to see Ruby Red, which ultimately becomes Mega Purple, which is kind of the great additive of California wine, how it starts out as grapes in the field. And it was neither as dramatically unsettling as I thought it might be, nor really inspiring. I mean, it was good to see that there is a way to make those numbers work, but at the same time, I had to keep asking myself, what's the quality of the wine that those go into? And, you know, is there ultimately a sustainability in growing, let's say, Zinfandel for white Zinfandel at 18 tons an acre when you have to drill a new well every year at, you know, $250,000? I'm sure your listeners know that water is not an insignificant concern. And so I wanted to go out there because I wanted to at least explore the economics of what it means to try and make farming like that work.
You mentioned Mega Purple, and that was something that was an eye-opener for me as I was reading this book. I had not heard of this product before, but you call it the third rail of California winemakers, but apparently it's quite popular with many winemakers. Tell me more about Mega Purple.
Yeah, and I suspect Mega Purple probably isn't even as big a deal as it was a few years ago, but essentially it's a grape concentrate. They take, like I said, typically Ruby Red grapes, which are a cross that was designed in the 50s, I believe, and really intended mostly for color, and concentrate it enormously. And what it does to wine, and you add it in infinitesimal doses when you're blending, is two things. It adds color. So from an era when people worried about red wine being deep and inky, it would give that to a wine that was maybe a little bit sort of wimpy in its way. And it also adds, and people rarely discuss this part, it adds just a tiny bit of sweetness. And there's a lot of interest by larger scale wineries in finding ways to add just a bit of sweetness to wine without necessarily making a full-on sweet wine. And so Mega Purple is this very convenient way to tweak not only inexpensive wine, but also, and I think this is where it was unsettling for people, often very expensive wines, to add those two aspects and ultimately try to boost your prospects with critics. And it's not a fundamentally bad bad thing if you use it in cheap wine, but it is something where you have to ask, if you're paying $80 or $100 a bottle, why couldn't they have done the farming right so that they weren't having to add an additive, basically, at the end in order to come up with a finished product that was maybe more aesthetically pleasing? You know, why essentially weren't they doing their jobs in the first place?
Very interesting indeed. Let's talk a little about the world of the wine broker. This is another one of those areas in the world of winemaking that is rather tight-lipped, and people don't talk about it a lot. But you mention it in your section on the Central Valley that many of the big clients for some of the wine brokers wind up using grapes from other parts of the state.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's always been, you know, both the promise and also the, you know, the dark edge of the California appellation is, you know, if you're making sort of a California appellated wine, then you might get some of your grapes from, let's say, Monterey or from Paso Robles. But then, yeah, you're reaching out to a broker and you're looking for sort of, you know, bottom dollar grapes, often from the San Joaquin, and using that to essentially make your numbers a little better. You know, it's one thing even to do it in a wine that's just marked California, but when you suddenly see a wine that's, let's say, Central Coast or even Napa or Sonoma, where there's clearly, a little bit of Central Valley fruit used as an extender, I mean, that makes some economic sense. That's how the industry has operated, and in some ways, sort of historically, it's how fruit from the Central Valley was harnessed. Even I would say, before the modern era, even just in the years after Prohibition. But the flip side is, it really doesn't give people a sense of what California can do. It doesn't say, this is the value of, let's say, Lodi fruit, and Lodi has some fascinating, really kind of amazing places to grow wine, especially as you get out to eastern Lodi and you climb to the mountains. And I suspect that, if there were more attention, that people would start to find additional places. I'm just thinking of somewhere like, let's say, Oakhurst, where there's definitely at least a handful of really interesting vineyards as you start to gain a little more elevation, and get back up to places where you can, you get a little bit of cool nights and you can grow really good quality grapes. But that's just not the way the industry's set up. The industry is configured in some ways to just make the consumer in, let's say, Kansas or in Tennessee or in New York just think about California overall. And I would argue, I don't think that's ultimately done the growers of California a service, because it hasn't let people really start thinking specifically about what it means if a wine is from Lodi, let's say.
You mentioned the winemaking programs at UC Davis and Fresno State. Are those programs obviously very focused on the technical, the scientific side of winemaking? Are they turning out this new generation of winemaker? Where are they coming from? And are they going to adapt to this new trend in some way? Can they bring more of an artistic element to their programs and their winemakers?
I think they're making a lot of progress, and I should also, to be fair, I should also probably put Cal Poly at SLO into that mix. I think there's been a lot of progress. The last time I was at Davis, I was talking to students who were absorbing the science and who were following the standard course at the V&E program, but who also were planning to go off and work with these very avant-garde producers in France or in northern Italy and, let's say, Friuli, and really were using their education essentially for great good, for the opportunity to work in an artisanal mold to make wines that are very traditional wines, simply with the perspective of a good winemaking education. And so I think that there's been a lot of progress. There's going to keep being progress in terms of wine education. But it's also always worth remembering that to some extent these programs are largely funded by big wine companies. And so ultimately their great goals are going to be to turn out folks who can work for big wine companies.
Before we go, where do you see things going from here? Is this a trend that has legs? Is it something that can continue to grow and sustain itself?
Yeah, I think it absolutely will. And I think it's not as though all of a sudden the industrial side of the wine industry in California is going to go away. It's absolutely there. It'll continue to be there, although I think it's going to face more economic pressures because farming, for many things, is going to become more complicated and more difficult. But it's always been the small, more elite producers that have led California and really that have defined it for consumers overall, but really that level of consumer that's interested in fine wine. And I think what's happening now, and it's growing almost faster than I can keep up with it, is that there is a realm of new young producers that are giving us what I would argue is this unprecedented diversity in American wine.
Our guest today has been John Bonnet. He is the author of a new book called The New California Wine, A Guide to the Producers and Wines Behind a Revolution in Taste. It's brand new on 10 Speed Press out of Berkeley. John is also the wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. John, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's all for today's Valley Edition. You can hear audio archives and subscribe to our podcast online at kvpr.org. We welcome your comments and suggestions. You can email us, talk@kvpr.org, and follow us on Twitter, @kvpr. For audio engineer Marv Allen, production and operations manager Don Weaver, Valley Edition producer Ezra David Romero, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation and the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.